This is Patty Has a Gun, the life and crimes of Patricia Hearst. I'm Brian Stelter, and this is our final episode in the series, episode 6, all about the explosive trial that Patty Hearst faced for her armed robbery of Hibernia Bank. We're going to talk about her defense at trial and the aftermath of her story. I'm joined again here by Jeffrey Toobin, CNN's chief legal analyst and the author of a book on this case, American Heiress. Jeffrey, in our last episode, you described Patty listing her occupation as an urban guerrilla, that's how she thought of herself and identified herself to the police when she was captured. Now, what's happening in the days after her arrest?
Well, this is the next transformation of Patty Hearst, the return of the old Patty Hearst. Her family, very much to their credit, surrounds her with love. Her mother, her father, her sisters. And she starts to recognize that there's not much in it for her to continue to be an urban guerrilla. The other key factor is the Hearst family hires a defense attorney for her, and they hire the most famous defense attorney in the United States, then and perhaps even now, F. Lee Bailey. And F. Lee Bailey decrees as his first instruction to his client, you are to have no more contact with your former comrades. We are cutting you off from any contact with Steve Solia, who was her lover. No more contact with Wendy Yoshimura. No more contact with Bill and Emily Harris. And the return of the old Patty Hearst is what is very much on the agenda of her defense attorney and on her family.
The innocent Patty Hearst, the woman that was brainwashed, that version.
First of all, it's a journalistic term. There is no medical phenomenon called brainwashing. But it is a term that came to light during the Korean War when certain American pilots were taken prisoner and wound up spouting North Korean talking points. F. Lee Bailey fought in the Korean War. He was a pilot during this era. And so brainwashing was very much part of his education. And his plan for the defense from the beginning was to argue that Patty Hearst had been the victim of essentially coercive brainwashing, that she was forced to become a member of the SLA, forced to believe that she could be an urban guerrilla. And that was the heart of her defense at the trial, which began in February of 1976, coincidentally, on the second anniversary of the day of her kidnapping.
Set the scene for us. How much coverage is this getting in the national media? How big a trial is this for the country?
The term trial of the century is always overused, and I admit I've used it myself, especially in the O.J. Simpson case, which was almost exactly 20 years after that.
Yeah.
But it was an enormously important trial in terms of public attention. The public, then as now, was transfixed on the question of how a wealthy heiress could go from being the victim of a horrendous kidnapping to being apparently a revolutionary soldier in the Symbionese Liberation Army. What's also so interesting about the trial is that the facts themselves of what happened, and she's on trial for the Hibernia Bank robbery in San Francisco, the facts of the case are essentially undisputed. Everybody agreed Patty Hearst was inside the bank. Everybody agreed that she went in with the SLA, that she left with the SLA, that they stole the money, that she carried the machine gun. The only issue in her trial was what was in her head. Was she coerced or was she a voluntary participant? So it was a remarkable study in personal motivation. What makes people do the things that they do? In part, the trial was a battle of experts. Both the prosecution and the defense retained very distinguished psychiatrists who examined Patty Hearst. The prosecution psychiatrists said what she did was voluntary. The defense psychiatrist said she was coerced. But the key moment in the trial was Patty Hearst's own testimony. And that was, by all accounts, the turning point.
Now, explain to us why she's only being tried for one thing, for the Hibernia Bank robbery. After all, there were numerous crimes committed during this time. Why just that one robbery?
It remains controversial to this day because she's the only one tried at first. Bill and Emily Harris aren't tried. And there are these other two bank robberies in Sacramento, including the one where Myrna Opsahl is killed. So the reason they try Patty Hearst first, and I think the U.S. attorneys would admit this, is because she was Patty Hearst, because she was such an enormous celebrity and so important. The other reason is that they had video, or they had surveillance camera photographs that were stitched together into making a video. They thought they had an open and shut case, because unlike the later bank robberies, where it was somewhat unclear who was inside the bank, what happened exactly, who was behind it, here they had Patty Hearst carrying a machine gun inside the bank. So they thought that they could get an easy conviction, and they had a celebrated defendant whom they wanted to try.
And we also have to keep in mind the six who died in the shootout and fire, that the people who originally pulled off this kidnapping were not able to be prosecuted.
Very big point, except for Bill and Emily Harris, who were not inside the bank. They drove the getaway cars, so their role in the Hibernia Bank was more difficult to prove. But all the rest of them, Nancy Ling Perry, who's in the video, Sin Q, Donald DeFries, who's in the video, they're dead by that point and can't be prosecuted.
So the police, so the prosecutors, so the authorities, they start with Patty Hearst. They prepare for this trial. They have a few months to prepare. What was she telling her defense lawyers? What was she telling her family at the time?
It's a gradual process. One of the documents that I got for my book that had never been public before was a letter that she wrote to Steve Solia right after she was arrested. And it was very much a revolutionary rant. You know, we're going to continue our fight. She spells America AMERIKKKA in this handwritten letter. I mean, that's sort of what her state of mind was. But her family, her friends start to come see her. And also, I think it's appropriate to bring a measure of cynicism to Patty Hearst's story as well, which is she sees there's no future in being a revolutionary. She sees the only way to get out is to claim that she was coerced. And certainly by the end, she feels that she was coerced. And just as her ticket to survival was becoming an SLA member, here her ticket to survival becomes asserting that she was never a member of the SLA.
So take us there to the moment she takes the stand.
Well, this turns out to be the turning point of the case, as it often is when the defendant takes the stand in a criminal trial. But here there's a very important legal issue that really turns the tide, and it relates to the scope of cross-examination. Lee Bailey puts Patty Hearst on the witness stand, and she tells a very compelling story on direct testimony about her kidnapping, about her abuse at the hands of the kidnapping, about how she felt like if she didn't participate in the bank robbery at the Hibernian Bank, she would have been killed. And that's her story on direct examination. Well, when James Browning, the U.S. attorney, and he gets up to cross-examine, he doesn't just cross-examine about Patty Hearst's behavior in the bank. He tries to ask her questions about the other crimes she committed while she was on the run, including the bank robberies in Sacramento. F. Lee Bailey objects. She says it's irrelevant. It is outside the scope of the direct testimony. He shouldn't be allowed to ask her questions about these other actions. The judge says, no, I am going to allow this cross-examination. I am going to allow the questioning about the shootout at Mel's Sporting Goods, about the other bank robberies. So at this point, Bailey has a big problem, because if she admits on the witness stand that she has taken part in the bank robbery in Sacramento where Myrna Opsahl died, that is potentially a death penalty case. It's called felony murder. If you participate in a bank robbery where someone is killed, even if you don't pull the trigger, you can be liable. So Bailey cannot allow her to admit to her involvement with the other crimes. But the judge is allowing the questioning. So what does Bailey do? He tells Patty to take the fifth in front of the jury 42 times. 42 times James Browning asks a question about this other criminal activity, and in front of the jury, Patty says, I decline to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me. That is poison for a jury. A jury who hears a defendant take the fifth, usually when a defendant takes the fifth, the jury never knows it. But here, because she had actually started to testify on direct, she has to either answer questions or take the fifth. And the fact that she took the fifth turns out to be very damaging to her case.
And we know that now because the jurors later said so.
The jurors later said so. And there is also a last minute twist, a piece of evidence that surfaces at the last minute that also seals Patty's fate.
We'll be right back with more of Patty Has a Gun right after this break.
Mm-hmm. I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Jeffrey, tell us more about this twist.
Obviously, the key issue in the case is whether she has joined the SLA or not, or whether she's coerced. Bill and Emily Harris give an interview to a magazine called New Times during the trial. A paralegal on the prosecution team notices the interview and brings it to the attention of the prosecutors.
Emily stated that Willie Wolf had given Patty a token of his love. It's called an Olmec monkey. We heard about this Olmec monkey on the SLA tape.
The pigs probably have the little Olmec monkey that Cujo wore around his neck. He gave me the little stone face one night.
When she was arrested, the Olmec monkey that Willie Wolf gave her was in her purse.
Bill and Emily Harris say in their interview, it shows how much Patty loved Willie Wolf that she kept another Olmec monkey with her at all times. In the middle of the trial, the prosecution team goes to the FBI and says, go back to the evidence room and find what was in Patty's purse at the time of her arrest.
It looked like a stone or a rock. We didn't know it was, quote unquote, the old McMonkey. I was in the courtroom. Jim passes this article by Emily and Bill Harris to me and says, "What, you know, with a note, what do you think?" And I just wrote back to him, no woman would carry a token of a rapist.
And the prosecution introduces the matching Olmec monkeys, the one that Willie Wolf was wearing when he died and the other that Patty Hearst was carrying when she was arrested a year and a half later. And the jurors later say, we were persuaded that that shows she really did love Willie Wolf and she really was a member of the SLA.
So there were no cameras in this courtroom, but I can imagine what a dramatic moment that would have been at the trial.
It was an old-fashioned Perry Mason moment when they brought out the Olmec monkey.
So now, so many decades later, how does Patty explain something like that?
Well, it's very important to point out that the narrative laid out by the SLA and laid out by the prosecution is one that Patty has rejected, both in many interviews. She wrote her own book, a very compelling book called Every Secret Thing. And in the many times Patty Hearst has told the story since 1975, she has said the same thing, that this was a horribly violent kidnapping, that she was held prisoner in the house in Daly City, that she was raped there by Willie Wolf and Sinku, that she was on the run with them for a year and a half, but she spent the entire time in fear for her life. And the only reason she participated in these crimes, the Hibernia Bank, the two bank robberies in Sacramento, the shootout at Mel's Sporting Goods in Los Angeles. In all of those, she said the only reason she did what she did was that she was in fear for her life and that she did not intentionally join the SLA. The only reason she remained with them is because she was afraid that she was going to be killed if she tried to leave.
Coerced or a willing participant, this is what the jury had to decide. And what did they decide?
The jury said guilty. There were two counts, bank robbery and possession of a deadly weapon, and she was convicted on both counts before her. She was then sentenced to 7 years in prison by the federal judge.
Now, Jimmy Carter's the president at this time, and he gets involved.
The Hearst family really mobilizes after her conviction, even before her appeals are denied, which they were. Jimmy Carter takes an interest in the case, as does Ronald Reagan. And I think this is important. Ronald Reagan, who was governor of California at the time and getting ready to run against Jimmy Carter, takes the Hearst family side and says her sentence should be commuted. This was an unfair conviction. So there was no political risk. And there's an intervening criminal event that takes place while Jimmy Carter is deciding whether to grant her a commutation. Jim Jones, the People's Temple in Guyana, the quasi-religious figure from California, leads his delegation into the swamps of South America and comes to direct them to commit mass suicide. And more than 900 people drink poison and they all die. And it's just this incredibly tragic, dramatic story that is dominating the American news. And it leads to national debate about why people do things that are self-destructive. Why do 900 people drink Flavor-Aid that's going to kill them? And the recognition that people sometimes do things that are against their self-interest. This is an argument that Patty Hearst's side is making. And ultimately, Jimmy Carter grants her a commutation of her sentence. She is freed from prison after serving about 2 years.
Now, I think she would say she was in prison once with the SLA and then in prison with the government, and now she's finally free.
And she is totally free after 2 years.
Are there any other legal consequences later? Because I know there were later trials of other people.
Well, the later saga of the SLA becomes extremely complicated and goes on for many, many years. But for Patty Hearst, it's all over. She does not get prosecuted again for her other criminal activities. Bill and Emily Harris plead guilty to the kidnapping. They serve about 6 years for that. Many years later, they are prosecuted for the bank robbery where Myrna Opsahl is killed, and they serve another 7 years for that. So they both serve in the range of 12 or 13 years in prison. Patty Hearst's family reaches a private civil settlement with Myrna Opsahl's family. And you may remember that Kathy Solia is one of the people who sheltered Patty Hearst, was involved in the bombings, in the bank robberies. She flees in 1975 to Minneapolis, where she takes on a new name and starts a whole new life, marries a physician, has children, changes her name to Sarah Olson. Many years later, thanks to the TV show America's Most Wanted, she is caught and she ultimately pleads guilty and serves a few years, also involving the bank robbery where Myrna Opsahl was killed in Sacramento.
But why wasn't Patty ever held accountable for the other crimes? Why did she never stand trial?
I think it was a combination of factors. One is that it would have required trying her again when she had just gotten a commutation and public opinion had shifted in her favor. So there was not a big appetite for that. Also, incriminating her would have required getting the testimony of the other SLA members who were not yet convicted and were not willing to testify at all. So there was a real problem of proof.
What has her life been like since? I mean, I remember she was pardoned by Bill Clinton, right?
Now, it's worth pausing to recognize that. Here she is. She gets a commutation after 2 years. This is something that almost no federal prisoners ever get. But that's not enough for Patty Hearst and the Hearst family. At the end of Bill Clinton's presidency, the family mobilizes again. Jimmy Carter takes her side, you know, by then an ex-president. And they go to Bill Clinton. They say it's not enough that she has a commutation. She needs a pardon. It has no particular significance to her at that point. You know, she's had her voting rights restored, but she wants the vindication of a pardon. And on the last day of Bill Clinton's presidency, January 20th, 2001, she gets a pardon from Bill Clinton. And she is the only person in modern American history to receive a commutation from one president and a pardon from another. And I think that alone tells you something about the value of power and wealth in the United States, that she could manage to accumulate both of those when, you know, there might be other deserving people in the federal correctional system as well. But she gets the pardon and she gets the commutation.
For me, it was more an issue of vindication as opposed to, you know, not having to put on a form, you know, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Or, you know, that was never really the problem. The problem for me was always how all of this happened and how the conviction, you know, got to being a conviction in the first place.
It speaks to the power of the Hearst family.
To this day, yes.
Does she talk at all about this period in her life? Does she give interviews? I know you tried to interview her for your book and she declined.
And we tried to interview her for our CNN documentary and she declined. Her pattern has been to give a lot of interviews, but only to people who don't know a lot about the facts of the case. So she is allowed to tell her story without much challenge. She's not asked about shooting up Mel Sporting Goods. She's not asked about the bank robberies in Sacramento. And she, of course, wrote a book, Every Secret Thing, a very compelling book, but of course, is her own story in her own terms. In terms of Patty Hearst's life, perhaps one of the most amazing things about how she has lived her life is that She has led the life for which she was destined. She has become a rich lady in the suburbs. She married her bodyguard, who was former San Francisco police officer. They married and they had a long and happy marriage and had two daughters, one of whom is an actress, one of whom works in Hearst Publications. Tragically, Bernie Shaw, her husband, died of cancer in 2013. And in the years since, Patty Hearst has become a very successful trainer of show dogs. She goes to a lot of dog shows, including the Westminster Kennel Club, which is the biggest dog show in the country here in Madison Square Garden. And she raises and trains fancy dogs, which is a pretty nice occupation for a rich lady in the suburbs, which is what she is.
Why didn't she cooperate with you?
Well, I think in fairness to her, this is not a part of her life that she likes reliving. She didn't want to go back to it. She has moved on in her life, and I can certainly understand that. That's a sympathetic version of why she didn't cooperate. A perhaps more cynical view of why she didn't cooperate is that she didn't want to be asked hard questions about parts of the stories that she doesn't like to talk about, like shooting up Mel's Sporting Goods, like the bank robberies in Sacramento, like trying to set off bombs under police cars in San Francisco, which is one of the things she did. So, you know, she has a version of the facts. It's out there. I don't think she wanted to relive it. And she certainly didn't want to answer hard questions about it.
She came out with a statement recently. She said that you have a distorted view of what happened. Have you ever talked to her since your book came out?
I have never talked to her. And I do think it's important to point out that Patty Hearst has a very different interpretation of the facts here than I did. But I think that's part of what makes this story so compelling, even all these decades later, that it remains a mystery at some level. And it's a mystery about the oldest of human questions, which is, why do people do the things they do? And, you know, there is very little doubt about what Patty Hearst did. No one doubts she participated in the bank robbery. No one doubts she shot up the street in Los Angeles. No one doubts she was involved in the bank robberies in Sacramento. But the key question and the key mystery is why? Why did she do it? Was she coerced? Was she a volunteer? And that question is what our documentary is all about.
And there you go. Yes, indeed. That documentary series, The Radical Story of Patty Hearst, that's the television companion to this podcast. You can check it out on CNN Go or CNN's other on-demand platforms. It features new interviews with Bill Harris and other figures involved in this case. There really are so many components to the Patty Hearst saga, so many versions of this story to explore. Jeffrey, thanks so much for being here. I'm Brian Stelter. We both want to thank you for tuning in to this 6-episode podcast series. Thanks so much for joining us on this journey.